attorneys don't object, if the judge just sentences and they walk away, then it won't happen.
But I thought Mr. Jones testified to us that they don't have that.
Well, I'm sure that happens, that the reasons aren't there because the attorneys didn't say, please state the reasons for the record. But if any attorney wants the judge to state reasons for the record, they are mandated to do it. And if they, a case can be reversed on appeal
but
just
they
because...
But is there criteria that they have to make the finding?
The criteria are case-made law, and they're still developing.
Okay,
this is an attempt to...
How do you feel about this criteria?
I feel about the first criteria for A, that it's generally trying to get at the right thing. However, the wording, an indication of defendant's willingness to commit more than one criminal offense, which appears at the bottom of page one, is unfortunate wording. I just don't have the faintest idea what that means. It seems to me that whenever somebody is in the course of conduct and they're committing crimes that can be divided into several things, that they're always indicating a willingness to do that. So it seems to be meaningless language. The problem is that they've correctly stated a concept that comes from case law, in that it's conduct which is not merely an incidental violation of a separate statutory provision in the course of, I mean, that's something that we can get a hold of and deal with. But then they set it off against this other phrase. It would only make sense if the one phrase did not overlap with the other phrase, but it simply does, and it ends up making no sense.
Okay, thanks. All right, hey, Gary.
I think.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I just say I would wish they would work on that language, or the witness would work on that language.
Yes.
Do you think it's a good
point? Volume one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bill Gary, Deputy Attorney General. Department of Justice supports this bill. I have submitted written testimony which to a large extent overlaps with comments that Mr. Sandrock made, and I won't repeat myself given the lateness of the hour. Let me state a couple of general principles that we believe are embodied in the merger consecutive sentence portions of this bill, and then I'd like to respond briefly to some statements that were made by the prior witness. These are what we believe to be generally accepted principles that should guide lawmaking with respect to the criminal disposition process. Number one, the number of convictions that are entered against a person arising out of the same criminal episode should not be governed by the same inquiry that governs the question of what the appropriate punishment or sentence is for that individual. The law of merger, as it's called euphemistically, that has developed, combines two very dissimilar inquiries. How many crimes were committed, and what is the appropriate response publicly for those crimes? There's no reason to combine them. Number two, and this goes specifically to the issue of standards for the imposition of consecutive sentences. Basic principle is that similarly situated defendants convicted of similar crimes ought to be treated similarly. Under current law, that does not occur because it depends entirely on the whim of the sentencing judge, once there are multiple convictions, as to whether those sentences will be made concurrent or consecutive. And that can have a tremendous impact on the amount of time served, as Mr. Jones can testify, because of the effect of stacking the matrix. Number three, it is desirable for a variety of reasons that there be on a criminal record an historically accurate record of the criminal conduct and what crimes were committed. That does not occur now because we merge crimes.
Now listen, I think you were out of, weren't you out of the room during part of Mr. Sandrock's testimony?
Yes, I was, Mr. Chair.
You covered, so far, everything that you've told us about.
Okay. Let me go directly then to the principles that derive from those general, the specifics that derive from those general principles. Instead of talking about apples and oranges and merging convictions for the purposes of determining how many punishments should be imposed, we ought to start talking in the case law, in the courtrooms, both appellate and trial, about the right questions. We ought to be asking the right questions. We ought to be addressing the right issues. And that requires that you start making criteria for the imposition of consecutive sentences. Now, the previous witness stated that there are those criteria and they're judge-made. If there are, in my 3 years as Solicitor General handling all of the state's criminal appeals, I don't know what they are. I never saw them. There are principles that govern the question of when convictions merge, and of course that has an effect on how many consecutive sentences can be imposed, but they're not criteria such as are contained in this bill that relate to when consecutive sentences are appropriate.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
If we could just maybe get to some of the technical parts of the bill, because I think we do understand the philosophic arguments on both sides, but... What was your intent there? I don't know actually who drafted this, maybe to the Attorney General's office, but on these the two criteria, because I think that's a good idea. I like the idea of having the criteria. But I did think the previous witness did raise one point on that at line 24. I think the line 22 and 23 are pretty clear. What was the thought, or what is the concept about an indication of the defendant's willingness to commit more than one criminal act? Is it their emotional state, whether they had an intent, or whether it was some... Or what was the idea you're trying to get at?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hendrickson, there is, I believe, a distinction between a person who incidentally violates one statutory provision en route to committing another crime, another criminal objective, and a person who repeatedly commits criminal...
Could you give me an example, concrete
term? In State versus Garcia, this incidentally is derived largely from the Garcia distinction between kidnapping and an offense that is committed after the kidnap. In Garcia, the defendant kidnapped an individual and then raped and sodomized her. That, in our judgment, manifests a willingness, conscious willingness, to engage in multiple criminal acts. It is not simply incidental that he committed a kidnap and then raped her and then sodomized her.
For example, like the example where someone steals a car and there happens to be somebody else's clothing in it.
Or the handful of pencils that was mentioned earlier. Those are instances where you could not satisfy that criterion, because obviously a person who doesn't know that he's stealing a car that contains somebody else's belongings is not exhibiting a conscious willingness to engage in multiple thefts, but is merely committing a theft of a car that happens to have somebody else's property in it. Now, there is an amendment that was drafted in a conference committee that didn't find its way into this bill that specifically addresses that problem. But the question, I guess, that the committee has to ask itself as a matter of policy is do you want to say that you can't enter separate convictions when somebody steals property from more than one individual, given the fact that the entry of separate convictions for multiple victim crimes does not necessarily lead to the imposition of multiple punishments? Again, you have to separate those inquiries.
No, there's a... I think keep in the State versus Gilbert, because that was the first case that construed the theft provisions of the new criminal code in terms of receiving. It was a receiving stolen property situation, and this defendant was found in possession of a number of weapons, all of which had been stolen from various people around about, but he had them all in his possession. And so he was charged with theft by a receiving, and for each one of these separate guns. That's the way I recall that particular case. And there was a case that was decided, I can't remember the name of it, but it was an 1880-something Oregon case where we all looked at it in law school, at least those of us that went to Oregon, where the fellow stole the horse, which had a saddle and a bridle on it, and the eager district attorney charged him with three separate offenses: theft of the horse, theft of the bridle, and theft of the saddle. I think most every Oregon Law School graduate remembers that case. And the Supreme Court said, in effect, that you can only slice the pie once, and the theft of the horse included the theft of everything else, and that was just one crime. And that was the law for all those years until about 1975 or something, when State versus Gilbert came down. and construed the new criminal code to make that three different thefts, the bridle, the saddle, and the horse. And I guess the point is, well, I happen to represent Gilbert, that's why I know so much about that case. But the point is, with me, is why was it sufficient and adequate to prosecute that person for one theft for all these years? And what are we accomplishing now by saying that a person commits three thefts by one act? The example of the different properties in the car, where you steal a car and you... Now, under this bill, with the fellow that steals the horse, could he be subject to consecutive sentences, three consecutive sentences for the single act of stealing a bridle, a saddle, and a horse at one and the same time?
Mr. Chair, my answer to that is no, based upon the criteria. Yes, there are three crimes under this bill as it's drafted now, but you can't satisfy the requirement that you find a conscious willingness to engage in multiple criminal conduct. You can't find that the risk of harm was qualitatively different. And I don't think that even if you could get past that, you could find that the time provided for one theft is not commensurate to the nature of the crime that was committed. So I don't think that a court would permit the imposition of consecutive sentences in that provision.
Right now, that probably could be done, though, couldn't it?
Under Gilbert, I believe they could. Now, one of the things that Mr. Jacobson indicated was, if you want to fix Garcia, why don't you just address Garcia, and if you want to fix Lopez, why don't you fix Lopez? I don't think this bill is designed to fix Garcia or to fix Lopez. It's designed to fix the basic place where we believe the court went astray in dealing with multiple punishments by merging convictions. And we're very flexible, I think, as this bill reflects, and the 6 years of effort to address this problem reflects, in terms of specifics like the problem of property crime. But
which court is it that went astray there?
Started with the Oregon Court of Appeals, as a matter of fact. But it was in the Woolard case was adopted by the Supreme Court. A couple of other comments, and then I'll answer specific questions. Mr. Jacobson said that these provisions were in ballot measure 8. Obviously, they weren't the only provisions that were in ballot measure 8. Moreover, this bill is different than the merger and consecutive sentence provisions that were included in ballot measure 8. We made a conscious decision to go back to the compromise legislation that narrowly was defeated in the last session, rather than to take a more stringent proposal that was incorporated in ballot measure 8.
Is this the theory that's incorporated in the new initiative petition that's being put together?
This legislation is incorporated in the new initiative, yes.
Well, if the legislation doesn't help you out here, maybe the voters will next time around.
Well, I hope that we don't have to wait that long, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jacobson also indicated that there would be a horror story of potential litigation. I think there's a horror story of current litigation now. Nobody that I know of, from the best criminal defense lawyers, including the defense lawyers in this room, to the best prosecutors, understand and can predict what a court is going to do with a merger problem. And that's just something that ought not to be accepted when you're talking about the critical decision of sentencing.
How about instead of approaching the situation this way, what if we just increased the length of sentences for felony? I mean, take a Class C felony and say that the max would be 10, and on a Class B the max would be 20, and on a Class A the max would be 40. That would give the judge all that much more room, and we wouldn't get bogged down in this issue of merger and consecutive sentences. Would that take care of your problem if that happened?
Well, it's a substantially different approach, and I don't think it answers our concern.
But you're real, though. It seems to me the thrust of what you're doing here is you're trying to give the judge a more of a handle by being able to impose a longer period of imprisonment in certain aggravated situations. That's really what you want to do, isn't it?
That's part of it. But another part of it is to eliminate what is, in effect, rewriting history. We talk about a person breaking into a home with the intent to commit theft and attempting a theft. But take a situation where a person breaks into a home and commits a rape. that's a qualitatively different criminal action than a person that breaks into a home to see what he can find to steal and doesn't and gets scared away before he does it. And the record ought to reflect the difference between a burglar and a rapist and a simple burglar.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Doesn't that record reflect that now? Can't you charge on the basis of that right now?
Yes, you can charge. The jury can find the defendant guilty of both the rape and the burglary, but when it comes time for sentencing, the convictions will merge.
Well, what's first-degree burglary? Is that right? I don't practice criminal law anymore. I was notoriously unsuccessful. The Supreme Court ignored the legislative history of the criminal code and said that I was wrong and this guy could be convicted of multiple offenses. But aside from that...
Of course, your client was innocent, too.
Yeah. Aside from that, I lost my train of thought. Burglary, when you enter a house with the intent to commit a felony, that's a Class A felony, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So, in this situation, the fellow breaks in the house and commits a rape, he's eligible for a 20-year sentence, isn't he?
That's correct.
All right, and you think that the sentence isn't great enough?
It may or may not be, depending on the specific circumstances of the crime, but the one thing I'm certain of is that his criminal record ought to reflect two A felonies, because he committed a rape and he committed a burglary.
Well, but he's convicted both of them. Why do you say his record would not reflect it? It'll say conviction of so-and-so and conviction of so-and-so.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fadley,
the sentence may not, but his record will.
It actually is done in a lot of different ways in different counties, but the theory is the jury returns the verdict of guilty on the two crimes. When it comes time to the sentence, which is the execution of the judgment will be entered finding him guilty only of the greater crime if they merge.
But the pre-sentence report, which is mandatory, would show that, wouldn't it?
Pre-sentence report would describe the entire criminal episode in a narrative form.
And it would indicate in there that the indictment charged him with both offenses.
Most of the time they show what the indictment charged and what the jury found and then will indicate that they're merged.
Yeah.
But if you plug it up on the criminal information network, it will show one conviction.
If the problem is records, then why aren't we correcting the records issue instead of trying to go at it with this method?
I think that's what the anti-merger provision of this bill does. And then it starts us talking about what is the appropriate response in terms of sentence to the course of criminal
record,
conduct.
I'm talking about just documenting pre-sentence so you get them laid out there so it's not a narrative. So everybody knows for the criminal history and for the parole board exactly what these offenses have been, the charges were, etc. Why don't we, if all we're after is to get a more complete history, then why don't we get a complete history?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, I'm not. As I said, I think that what we're after is to have as many convictions entered as there were crimes committed that the person was found guilty of. And
can enter them all, and they don't have to be sentenced. They don't have to have anything to do with what we're talking about here.
That's right, and that's what this bill does. It enters them, and then it provides a procedure by which you engage in a separate inquiry as the sentencing judge as to what the appropriate sentence is for that course of criminal conduct. And the judge can consider at that point whether multiple punishments or consecutive sentences are appropriate given the criteria that we set forth.
Yeah, but you just need two lines to say that the multiple convictions will be entered as each conviction will be entered on the record. When a jury convicts a person of two offenses, the both offenses shall be entered on the record. That's two lines in one sentence.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fadley, when we started back in 79, that's not very far away from what the bill said. This bill has been, and it was only one bill. We had only an anti-merger provision. We didn't have anything to do with consecutive sentences. Over time, not only have we become flexible because of the crucible of compromise that is the legislative process, but I think also most of the district attorneys and certainly the Department of Justice has become persuaded that you ought to have standards for consecutive sentences.
Well, that's a different issue than the one that you were making the argument on, and there are a couple of things in this bill I haven't heard anybody testifying about. including having a reunion gathering of all of the folks there at the time of sentencing. But in other words, there's some issues in the bill that haven't directly been addressed. The reason we're asking the question is it does seem, at least to me, that it's unduly complicated way of achieving one of your goals. You're telling me that the result will be that, but normally you have a compromise that makes things clearer. And if this is a compromise, it's made it harder for people to follow what your real goal is, for sure.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fadley, I understand, and it would be, you know, as a general rule, if you can say it in one sentence, it's better to say it in one than ten. And we certainly try to make this as clear as possible. It's in everybody's interest. We're trying to avoid litigation and make clear rules. We think that to accomplish what we want to accomplish, this is what we have to do. Let me make one other comment with regard to your observation that there are provisions in this bill that haven't been addressed. That's correct. From the Department of Justice standpoint, this is a merger consecutive sentence bill. I believe that's the view of the District Attorneys Association as well. If the victims' rights provisions in this bill are the least bit controversial, it is our sincere request that they be dropped and that it not end up jeopardizing the more important provisions of the bill from our perspective.
Peter Sandler did talk about appointment. Okay? I do want to cut you off because I realize this is important to you. If you're not finished, go ahead. I'll bear with you another. I realize this is important to you, but it's also, I mean, I think it's an understatement when Senator Fairley said that this whole thing seems much more complicated than it ought to be. If we're trying to arrive at a compromise, it's terribly complicated. And this is my second session on it. Senator Fadley's third session, or fourth, or something like that. Senator Simmons has been through it. Senator Cohen's been through it, two or three sessions. I want you to feel like you've been heard. I don't know what the committee wants to do with the bill, but I think we understand it fairly well. You know that it is complicated. And I'm glad you mentioned what you did, because it seems to me that the bill does kind of have two divisions, victims' rights. And go ahead.
I appreciate your indulgence. You gave me an extra 15 minutes from what you indicated. This is the reason that you end up with a bill that is longer than one sentence is because as we sit in committee hearings or as we sit in sessions with the defense attorneys and so forth, you get the kind of hypotheticals that you've heard here today. Well, what if this? What about that? And what about that? And in attempting to ensure that we're not making bad law, we've attempted to address all of those concerns. If we've done that to a fault, that's the reason why. The bill was 6 years in the making to get where we are now, and we respectfully request your favorable action on it.
All right. Well, I appreciate the work you, Senator Simmons.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman. When do we eat?
We're going to eat just 2 minutes, and I'll send it around for the hamburgers. Okay. I appreciate your efforts in these past 6 years. It may be that you're going to have to keep working on it. I don't know. Now, was this a matter that was taken up with the Interim Committee of Judiciary in the last interim?
It wasn't taken up in the last interim. It was taken up on the Task Force on Sentencing in 1981. And I will tell you that the result of that, no legislation came out of that Task Force on Sentencing. And the Task Force did not even recommend addressing this problem because they couldn't see their way out of the problem.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. What have you done to involve the judges and the sentencing guideline people? I mean, I guess I have a real concern that we've got a battle between between the prosecutors and the defense people, and we don't have in order to get everybody on the table up where we can do something, you're going to have some of the judges who are actually involved in. And I want to know, have they been involved in preparation of this?
Senator Cohen, excuse me, in 1983, the informal working group that Representative Myers put together included representatives of the Prison Overcrowding Project, representatives of the circuit judges, and although not directly involved in the meetings that took place in this building, appellate judges have also had input on this bill.
Okay. Thanks again. Thanks all of you. It's 8:20 and the committee's adjourned. Senator Collins starts talking about putting...